This is What Goddesses Watch, a film and TV podcast that takes a divinely badass dive into the feminine on screen. With me, Soma Ghosh, film critic and editor of the Demented Goddess magazine. Welcome to episode 2 of the new What Goddesses Watch series. And today I've got Pragya Agarwal. Pragya, hello.
Hi, Soma. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. I've just been setting up the shepherd's hut here, sort of getting insulated with loads of cushions against this wonderful wall of summer sound in the Welsh marches of swallows and swifts and sparrows. So that's pretty nice. And I'm also really happy that today we're going to be talking about Ama Gloria and Presumed Innocent. I'm loving the contrast. And just a little bit about why I thought it would be great to talk with you about it. You've had this wonderful, very honest book out inquiring about mothering called Motherhood. I also, by the way, loved your TED talk on creativity. And Ama Gloria today is by Mariama Cicchelli. It's in UK cinemas from the 14th of June. And we're talking about that alongside David E. Kelly's Presumed Innocent, which is out on the 12th of June. Co-directed by Anne Sawitsky and Greg Yatanis, and starring Jake Gyllenhaal. Ruth Negger, whom I loved in Passing, which we've covered in a previous What Goddesses Watch, and Renate Reinsver, whom I also really enjoyed in The Worst Person in the World. So before we talk about that, what else have we been watching? Have you managed to watch anything else? Any guilty pleasures or serious thoughts?
I try not to feel guilty about the pleasure. but yes, I do watch a lot of TV because when you're working from home writing, I sometimes use TV as a backdrop. But I recently watched Past Lives, which I know I'm late to it. But I absolutely loved it. It's beautiful. It made me think a lot about language and diaspora and the kind of identities we contain within ourselves, the multiple identities. And of course, I watched Bridgerton because it's so sumptuous and there are lots of things that I've been thinking about there as well. So those are a couple of things recently I've seen.
Yeah. And with Past Lives, it's a really interesting inquiry, as you say, into diaspora, into what we leave behind us and what we carry with us. And that's that element, that bittersweet questioning element of loss, subverting a typical kind of rom-com structure, I thought was great. And speaking of romance, Bridgerton aside, I would say it's a guilty pleasure because I kind of knew that it wasn't going to be that great. But we've been rereading Pride and Prejudice to my little boy, who has a thing about enjoying 19th century novels at bedtime. And so I watched Death Comes to Pemberley, which is an old BBC genre mashup of period drama meets murder mystery. And I found that BBC are often, it's often the case I have with them, with the classics, I found them a bit sort of too, they're either too reverent or too heavy. And it just made me think, it's interesting questions about adapting from a text and adapting from a text from a different time. And I think that there is a real trouble with adapting and a challenge, which can be wonderful about adapting Austen, whereby it's difficult to manage her combination of real, like, lightness alongside deep insights into character and moral growth. But actually the most interesting aspect of that, speaking of diaspora, was kind of about belonging and the Wickham character, if you remember Dastardly Wickham, who turns up accused of a crime and is sort of somewhat rehabilitated. So that was like a surprising, I would never have watched it, but I did watch it, and it always gives you stuff to think about. So speaking of which, moving to Presumed Innocent, I'm making that link with this adaptation of another novel. So this is an adaptation of 1987 New York Times bestseller by Scott Truro, and it's been given the J.J. Abrams and David Kelly big Hollywood treatment. It's the story of the chief deputy prosecutor of Chicago, Rusty, played by Jake Gyllenhaal. He finds himself accused of the sadistic, brutal murder of his fellow prosecutor, played by Renate Reinsfer, with whom it emerges he's been having this obsessive and loving affair. So I know you're a bit of a Jake Gyllenhaal fan. Is that fair to say?
I am. I think, and it's kind of this, watching this confirmed that, because I'd kind of forgotten about it, but every time I watch him, but that aside, I think I really found it interesting. I hadn't read the book or watched, there was a film, I think, with Harrison Ford or in 1990s, perhaps, of it, which I hadn't watched. But this was really interesting because I am interested in bias and legal bias, and doing some research in that as well. And Ruth Negga, I'm a big fan as well of her work.
Yeah, I wanted to watch it particularly because of Sawitsky's involvement. I was curious to see how a woman director would handle this extremely violent tale of what is done to women drugged, women abducted, but what is also done to powerful women who, in the case of this fellow prosecutor who's found murdered, are in charge of prosecuting men who rape and murder women. And I just wondered there's been this trend of, I mean, you might say that has been forever in culture, there's been this trend of TV shows around violence against women, as much as there have also, of course, been about violent women, Killing Eve being a touch point on that. And so this trend has kind of ranged from serious inquiry into rape and trauma, like I May Destroy You, to Shining Girls, which is another thriller, which I'd sort of, if you enjoyed Shining Girls, I feel like you would enjoy this. That was fronted and produced by Elizabeth Moss. And in many ways, that the sort of shiny, glossy photography for me I find the violence sort of easier to watch. But I guess my question is whether in some way series like this sort of glamorize and titillate around the brutally handled female body. What were your feelings?
Yeah, I was a bit concerned when the first episode, I think it took a while to get into it. And I think the first episode, I was concerned about that because we saw some graphic scenes and I was wondering how that would be tackled. Because as you say, sometimes it fetishizes and glamorizes violence and those kind of brutal killings. I think it was handled in a quite a nuanced manner. I think it was done quite sensitively as far as I watched it. Also, I can see how this story is about power and it's about misogyny. It's about men believing that they have this in power over women, implicitly often. And the kind of actions that they take because of that, how they can justify some of those actions like obsessiveness and justify it as love or affection, you know, and how a woman, even as powerful as the person here who was murdered, Caroline, how she couldn't get away from that kind of obsessiveness, even with all the power that she has, even with all the autonomy that she had. So I think some of that has been handled quite sensitively and delicately in this, about to show how the misogyny manifests in some of those and how systemic and structural some of those imbalances are.
I mean, I thought I did feel like there was a bit of an American defeat TV default to the enshrining of the heteronormative family, and oh, you know, it's so terrible. You're fucking your colleague, you know, with whom you have so much in common, and in many ways, the sort of so that I mean, I, the kind of repeated the repeated supposed sort of darkness around that, I did feel here this rather, for me, it rather dragged Ruth Negger's kind of lambent power as an actor somewhat down. I felt that that plus the arc of, well, you know, if you're a wife who forgives the, I'm using quote marks here that that our listening goddesses can't quite see, but I hope you can hear it in my voice. Yeah, that you somehow have to rehabilitate the marriage, and she questions whether or not why that should be her responsibility. She seeks to understand her sexuality elsewhere, but really the nuance that you're talking about, where it's there, and maybe I felt it less than you, was really, I thought, in the affair between Rusty and Carolyn. And it's interesting the way that they've chosen to carve that up, because we only get to learn about Carolyn, obviously, as the series goes on. And I would say, like you, that's, it sort of makes it more worth watching, because that sexual aggression between both of them is super interesting. It feels visceral, it feels emotional, it feels confused. And I find that Renate herself, that almost sort of angelic cleanliness that she has, married to the purity of her aggression, is quite exciting and fascinating. So for me, that was probably the best bit.
Yeah, I think I do agree with you about the whole heteronormative marriage aspects of it, how that's been portrayed and represented, because initially I was really getting frustrated and annoyed by the passiveness of Ruth Negger's character. Like, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you still here with him? You know, sort of. It's like, why do you keep forgiving him? There was no... And yes, as the series develops, the viewers will probably find that the character develops as well. But there is still that kind of focus on the family and keeping the family together, which I suppose it kind of draws from the conflict that maybe perhaps a lot of couples and parents feel that they have to do certain things to stay together, to hold it together, and that family structure is the best for children. And I think that conflict is kind of portrayed quite well, that both of them are finding happiness outside, but still staying together despite all their transgressions and everything. And I think that family life is portrayed quite well, the conflicts, but still it's like he has a lot of power even within that relationship as well, even though she tries to gain power slowly by her actions and by doing certain things. He holds a lot of power, and I think that what I found that really fascinating how that's shown here.
And all of the close-ups on Jake Gyllenhaal's wonderful face and those eyes, particularly when he's concealing and holding it in, the show is really, they see, to me there are two points, maybe three points, where it really gathers pace and emotional pace, and it is around his own inner confusion and his own turmoil, which I think is well done. The other point is around Carolyn, who as an enigmatic character, I think I think it's really Renate's acting that shifts that character out of the typical other woman model into something far more intriguing. But then I've just got to put in a word for Tommy Molto, so the antagonist played by Peter Sarsgaard, this creepy fellow prosecutor who's obviously obsessed by both Rusty and Carolyn, with his cat at home, with his with his big fluffy cat that he's, you know, that he loves at home. So I thought that almost that the series was almost at its best when it was in this sort of icky underbelly place. And I did find myself a little bit bored by the American family stuff. You know, I was like, I'm not sure I really care. So votes for Presumed Innocent then. So how many nymphs? So we've got a new system of how many goddesses, how many nymphs. So nymphs while watching, because while watching we might be in a kind of, you know, sort of playful mood, we're kind of growing, we're willing to give it a chance, and then goddesses as to the judgment afterwards. So how many nymphs while watching?
Is it from 1 to 5?
It's from 1 to 5, yeah.
Maybe 3, I would say.
Yes. And goddesses, little moment to reflect.
Oh, quite a lot, actually. It's made me think a lot. So maybe four, I would say. Or oh, I don't know if this is a generous estimate. I'll have to think about it, but.
Yeah. I mean, it's good, but we've had a good chat about it. This, which is nice. And I think I had a definite, I would say, maybe 3.5 while watching it. I enjoyed the pace of it. I enjoyed the ride of it, and I was fascinated by Carolyn's character and the kind of icky darkness. But maybe afterwards, a bit of a feeling of, well, what did that really add to my life? So maybe it went down to a 2 afterwards, actually. So that's where I'm at. Completely different to Ama Gloria. This film's coming out on the 14th of June, and the story here is we have 6-year-old Cleo, played by a 6-year-old, played by Louise Moy Panzani. Who's been raised and loved by Gloria, Ilcha Morena Zago, since her mother died. And when Gloria suddenly has to return to Cape Verde to look after her own children, Cleo follows for what will be their last time together, one last summer holiday with Gloria. And yes, and it's directed by Marie Amucchelli. So this film.
Oh, it's such a beautiful, heartrending film. I haven't stopped thinking about it since I watched it. I think it's a really emotional film. There's so many layers, there's so many complexities in it. To think about mothering and caring and nurture and different intersectional issues related to that as well. There's so much to say.
And it opens with Cleo having her glasses tested. She wears these very thick glasses, and so we begin with this visual metaphor of a sight test and how children see things. And the story is very much told from her point of view. We do see Gloria independently. We rarely see anybody else independently. And in that sight test, she's having difficulty, making out the letters. And Gloria tries to help her, which is a fantastic metaphor for how mother figures try to correct the way that we see the world, perhaps try to help us get ahead. But it that How we see the world is a journey that we have to make. Every individual has to make for themselves. And the respect that Amicelli affords Cleo was something that I really enjoyed. I admired that the tone of the film is it's innocent, but it's not sentimental at any point. And whereas when there are stories about whether it's a child or an ingenue, there can be a heavy use of dramatic irony. We can turn to the gothic. Particularly with dead mothers and so on. Here, you're just sort of waiting for Cleo's delicate, wholehearted trust to be abused or broken, but the sort of the luminous, quiet clarity of the photography cleverly hints at our knowledge of what she doesn't see, but it doesn't go to that place of pathos. And so for me, thinking about, a film that's using a child's point of view, it made me think about how we are all unreliable narrators because we're all embedded in our own view of the relationship and of our fear of losing the one whom we love. And we're all children who are can the same time take change in our stride, but also suddenly become terrified.
I think you're right. There is a lot. There's always this kind of fear that something will happen, something really bad will happen. That naiveness, that innocence, that trust would be broken. But it never falls into cliches. Their relationship is very real. It's just gritty at times, but very real. I think it also shows about how children in particular, but even when we grow older, a lot of the world that we see is from a self-centered perspective, and suddenly our lens can widen. So this happens with Cleo. Initially, her relationship with Gloria is very much just her and Gloria, but when she moves to Cape Verde, she sees that there are other responsibilities that Gloria has. She has other relationships, other connections which she hadn't even thought about or considered. So I think that the widening of the lens as we grow older and how we understand the perspective of others, which we often don't. And I think that's a really beautiful message that sometimes, even as adults, we forget that there are multiple views on the same world that we are perceiving. But initially, I think that the start of the movie is that the relationship is shown so beautifully. And I almost felt like this heavy load or burden of mothering when Gloria is taking care of her, doing everything, because the father is a single parent and he's busy working elsewhere all the time. So she's the really primary caregiver, and she's doing everything in the house, in the kitchen, and running after her bath time, bedtime, everything. And you suddenly feel like this sense of this huge physical, emotional, mental labor that caregivers have to carry, even when they are not perceived to be mothers. And it made me think a lot about the class inequalities as well, about the inequalities in our society, about who does the caregiving and who is rewarded for that labor, you know, and how are they rewarded and how are they perceived, and how we view motherhood only as this biological thing, but not focus on the mothering aspect of it, and how we dismiss the mothering aspect of it and define mothers so very narrowly. And so that made me think a lot about the Indian nannies that I saw when I was growing up or around me, especially in the very affluent parts of Delhi, where they would leave their children behind in villages to come and look after the children of the affluent people in Delhi, New Delhi. And so their children are being looked after by somebody else, by the elder members of the family. They are here to earn money, but they also build this really strong connection with the children, but they are not their children. So they don't have any ownership or agency or autonomy or anything like that. So I think, and I wrote a little bit about that in my book, about how that those inequalities really, really bothered me then. And I watching this reminded me of that as well.
Yeah, at the same, I mean, it's really interesting to see the figure of the nanny, and as you say, of alternative mothers, which is what she really is, which in affluent Western culture, and Gloria's silent struggle leaving Africa and her children is seen, for example, in, and I just want to talk about this throughout the film. Cleo's imaginings of Gloria and her memories, because Gloria has been with her since she was an infant, are expressed through these painterly beautiful cartoons, where the enormous sea that she imagines, it has to be enormous because Gloria has this little locket of a whale at her throat, which comes into Cleo's vision when she's bathing her. This enormous sea is part of this sort of cartoon pauses, and what could be a bit of a sort of jar in the tone. Did you find that to be the case? Did you think they were necessary, or would you have been happy with the film without them?
I think they were a beautiful addition. I really liked that. It's like slightly artistic aesthetic angle to it, but it's also a very childlike, dreamlike state, you know. I loved that this is a childlike view of the world, and it really made us think about how Cleo observes the world, what she dreams about, what she views. And it kind of said a lot of unsaid things in the film as well. So it captured the mood of the film. So maybe perhaps a couple of times they were a bit longer than what I would have thought that they were necessary, but I think they were a beautiful addition to the film.
And I think that I agree. I think I felt that they were a little much, as it were, just because I was actually enjoying all the light in the film, in the Paris parks and the modest middle class interiors, and in Cape Verde. So that was interesting, the use of light to express being here. And Cape Verde itself is beautiful. She learns to know the ocean, but it's not exoticized. And as we follow Cleo's point of view, whether she is exploring a tiny room in a tiny house or the big ocean, it's life just as Cleo finds it. And there is something actually quite healing for us experiencing that. So it's actually not just a film about a child and her alternative mother, but it's also a film about being and encountering the new and being able to encounter things, and that includes difficulty. So how she considers loss and grief in a child, that I found very interesting. So we see Cleo calmly refute, and she's a very self-possessed little girl, isn't she? Fantastic. And so we see her calmly refusing food or play from her teacher. With Gloria gone, Cleo's waiting at school. She's seemingly forgotten by her father. That's a moment of loss. And then we won't spoil it, but then there are two desperate acts after a new baby in Gloria's life demands attention. How did you respond to how the director is considering loss and grief in a child?
Yeah, I think talking about loss and grief with children is quite difficult. I know that from my personal experience, but about how sometimes I think we underestimate children about how they deal with such heavy topics, and we try and protect children, but I think children are quite matter of fact and they can deal with big things as well. Here, obviously, she's carrying the weight of her mother's death, and that has a moment that we see in the film where she suddenly has that realization. But also about little losses of her connection with Gloria, or about finding that maybe she's not the only person important in Gloria's life as before. And coming to that realization, I think it's portrayed so beautifully about the way the children deal with it, and the way that they feel they can't express it and articulate it. But they also are so forgiving to other people about other transgressions that they might feel. And I think, as you said, it's about being in the moment and not thinking about too much about the past or the future. It's about what is happening today and what I do today and how I'm feeling today. So I think those emotions are portrayed really beautifully, even when Cleo doesn't have the language to express them. I think the emotional range that's shown in the film is really beautiful. And coming back to what you talked about Paris and Cape Verde, I think the sense of place is created really beautifully in it. Cape Verde, we really get a sense of the place and the location and the people without creating any kind of sense of drama or catering to the Western audience, I suppose. And it's just life as it's happening. And we also see that Gloria is struggling with her relationship with her own son, who she's left behind. And so there's another side of that mothering that we see, how she's mothering her daughter and her son. And I remember one dialogue when she says, she's almost like my daughter, or she's like my daughter, Cleo. And I felt really sad for both Cleo and Gloria in that moment, where I thought, what does being a mother or a child or a daughter mean? And how we, because now Cleo is going to go back and the movie moves on. So I think the emotional range is really beautiful in the film. And it's not just Cleo's loss and grief, it's also Gloria's loss and grief as well, which we encounter, and how they come together or overlap and conflict with each other, I think is really beautiful.
Mm. Did you think, we're not going to say what they are, but did you go there with the desperate acts? Did you find that credible?
Yes, absolutely. It's so believable that a child would think that or do that. And I think a lot of adults might feel something like that as well. All this range of envy, jealousy, all those kind of things. But perhaps as adults, we are not as able to admit to those feelings. We are not able to confess to those feelings. We suppress them sometimes. But all those feelings, I think people encounter, and I'm sure children encounter that. It was so believable, I think. And that is what I think, that it no, none of the characters are either completely good or completely bad. And I think that is a real credit to the director because and the storyteller, because it there are shades to every character, you know.
Yeah, and it I like the f it was interesting that we had this the childlike illustration of the hidden memories and the hidden feelings through the cartoons, but it didn't go off into a fable, which Petite Maman, Celine Sciamma's Petite Maman, is a I guess a sort of kind of twin to this film in terms of a young girl who's experienced loss, trying to kind of understand that or come to terms with that. I felt for me, I found Cleo's final encounter with the ocean slightly stretched credibility. But I did really enjoy, as I said, the build of her learning. And it's not like she ever, that also, it's not as if she loses its innocence through her experiences, and that as well. It's just a tr the whole film I found is a triumph of tone in that regard. That as long as that we can have love and compassion for what we do, which after all is sort of triumph, if you like, of mothering in a non-biological in any kind of form or from any gender. That if we can have love and compassion for the experiences that we encounter, that we might survive. So yeah, so it's a sort of surprisingly wise film. I had it was in awe of its tone. I love the light. As you said, the acting is glorious, and particularly Louise Mauri Panzani is a marvel.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something. I think it's I was also thinking about this and Presumed Innocent, and although they're very different stories and different things, but I was thinking about the mothering in Presumed Innocent as well, about how even Caroline, when her son is talking about her and about she didn't have a relationship with him, and I don't want to go into too much detail,
No.
but the series kind of builds into that bad mother narrative a little bit, although doesn't go too much into it because she's an absent mother and she's not there for the child. And in this, we see the father who's not a bad father, who loves Cleo, but he's almost an absent father. He's forgotten that she's at school and forgotten to pick her up. And I was just contrasting that about how those gender norms and stereotypes play out. And so I think there is a bit of a connection between the two in terms of how mothering is represented. In the other one, we've seen Ruth Negga's character trying doing all this for her children because she's the mother and she feels that responsibility. And in this, we see mothering in a different, completely different light as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah. So votes for Amor Gloria. So while watching, how many nymphs?
Five, I think five. I loved it. I really loved it. It's beautiful. It's heartrending. I cried a little bit as well.
Yeah. And so how many goddesses?
I would say five as well, perhaps, maybe. I'm
Yeah.
feeling very generous about it,
Yeah. Yeah.
but.
It's funny because I think I feel I actually found while I was watching it, I was enrapt. I was watching it and wanting everybody else around me who was kind of passing by to just, either be kind of pulled in and kind of come and see it with me, or just sort of leave me alone on a desert island. So I think it doesn't really get any better than that, without, as I say, obvious dramatic irony or a sinister overkill. So five while watching, and then I think probably I maybe had some artistic quibbles afterwards. So I still feel like it's a great journey, And I think there are just some things that I've, you know, I would have had less of the cartoons. I wasn't sure about where it went to at the end. So maybe 4.5. But yeah, I think that's maybe. But then on the other hand, you know, now we're talking about it again. You know, maybe we need some other level above goddesses. I don't know. What is above goddesses? Yeah. So, yeah, so I hope all our goddesses listening will give this film a go, because I mean it was very unexpected, very beautiful, and ran very deep. Yeah, so thank you for sharing all of that. It's interesting to hear your thoughts on The Nannies of India as well. Yeah, it's been great talking to you. Lovely to have you, and I'm going to enjoy maybe having a sneaky look at the very final episode of Presumed Innocent, despite the fact that I gave it 2, because I'm a total hypocrite.
You don't deserve it. No.
It's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Soma. Lovely to be here.
So it's been me, Soma Ghosh, speaking to our guest, Pragya Agarwal, about the sublime Amma Gloria, out on the 14th of June, and Apple's Presumed Innocent, which has its premiere this 12th of June. What Goddesses Watch is produced by Soma Ghosh, with audio producer Quiva Lavelle and music by Penelope Traps. You can talk to us at Twitter at Goddess Demented, Instagram at Demented Goddess Web Scene, and you can join us as a patron and be at the forefront of film podcast making about films about and by women. That is at patreon.com/whatgoddesseswatch, or if you're listening on rss.com, hit the donate button now.